We are. This is the Taylor Report. Welcome. CIUT 89.5 FM for our Canadian audience. Happy Thanksgiving for our American audience. Canadians have their Thanksgiving on October the 9th. Am I right?
Well, whatever the second.
What is it?
Whatever the second
right.
Monday is.
And the Americans.
The same day the Americans celebrate, you know who.
Do they?
Yeah, Columbus.
Oh, him.
Yeah.
Well, actually, there's a big argument. About
right.
It.
Yeah.
We're not doing Columbus today because he's not worthy, but we might talk about that at other time because his name is disappearing. At one time, Columbus Day, big deal. And anyway, we'll come to that. We're going to talk today with the author of Pan-Africanism and Communism, Hakim Adi. We will, at the halfway point, we'll be talking to David Himbara about his new book, Kagame's Killing Fields. And if you listen to Taylor Report, you know where we are talking here. David Himbara served in the government of Paul Kagame. He's lucky to be alive, according to British intelligence. A lot of people have lost their lives, and recently a presidential candidate, a second woman to challenge Paul Kagame for the presidency, is brought into court, over the weekend, I believe. She is due again in court with her mother and her sister very soon. So I want to remind everybody of what it is. Rwanda, one of the dear friends of the Canadian government, very close with the American Canadian government. Phil, we have an announcement about Mr. Hakim.
Right.
Hakim Adi.
At a different book list and cultural center. And Mr. Hakim Adi will speak on Sunday, October the 15th, that's next Sunday, at 3 p.m., Pan-Africanism and Communism with historian and author Professor Hakim Adi. And he is the author of Pan-Africanism and Communism, the Communist International, Africa and the Diaspora, 1919 to 1939. Very interesting subject.
Sunday the 15th,
3 p.m. at a different book list cultural center, 779 Bathurst Street.
Phil, thank you very much. And I believe we're joined by Dr. Hakim Adi. Are you there, sir?
I'm here. How are you doing?
Very well. We're looking forward to seeing you. This is a very important anniversary, the 1917, it's October, and I want to ask you, of course, some of the themes you're going to go into, but I would just say, prior to the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, there was a world socialist movement, and you have a quote in your book by one of the leaders of that movement, an American named Eugene Debs, and he says, "We really don't have much to offer to the Negro." And then you have a second quote from a wonderful figure in American history, W.E.B. Du Bois. And he says the test of the socialists is the Negro question. But those two quotes, if I remember rightly, are separated by the event of October 1917. And the issue of race and colonial oppression was suddenly moved from the bottom of the agenda to the top of the agenda. At least I get that impression from reading your book. What do you say?
Yeah, I guess there's some truth in that. That the October Revolution of 1917 was such an earth-shattering event, the 10 days that shook the world, that nothing was quite the same again. And I think everybody had to look at the world in a different way, and that also meant for many of those organizations that called themselves socialists or particularly after 1917 communists, that they also had to look at the world in a different way. And one thing which the Russian Revolution did was to change the perception, change the importance of the anti-colonial struggle. Perhaps before that time, there had been the thinking that revolution was most likely to break out in the so-called most advanced capitalist countries. But the analysis of Lenin and others was that revolution may well break out where the chains of imperialism were weakest, and that could be in one of the colonial countries.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is Hakim Adi. His book is Pan-Africanism and Communism, the Communist International, Africa, and the Diaspora, 1919-1939. Wasn't it a shock for the so-called socialists, and particularly, as you say, in the so-called advanced countries, that this Lenin represented the old international notion of human equality, that there wasn't a group or nationality or color of people who had to be raised and educated by white Europeans?
Yeah, that's quite right. And as I was saying earlier, this idea that only revolutions in the advanced countries or revolutions in the advanced capitalist countries were more important than anti-colonial revolutions, or that the struggles of workers of European origin were more important than struggles of workers of African or Asian origin. That notion, I think, was put into the dustbin of history, as it were. Mm-hmm. And Lenin and the Bolsheviks' analysis was that the anti-colonial struggles, the anti-imperialist struggles, were part of the world revolutionary struggle, were just as important. And when the Communist International was formed in 1919, it definitely took that approach, that the workers of all countries were equal. There were no advanced workers and backward workers in that sense. Mm-hmm. The struggles of all countries were, and all peoples were, important and needed to be organized accordingly. And of course, that approach, which an inherent part of it was anti-racism, if you like, mm-hmm. that approach led to many from Africa, from the diaspora, African Americans, both Africans who were based in Europe as well as in the African continent, the Caribbean and elsewhere. Many gravitated towards the Russian Revolution and the new socialist state that was being constructed in the Soviet Union. Yeah. And earlier you mentioned W.B. Du Bois. He was one of those who visited the Soviet Union in 1926. So when he returned, he said that if this is Bolshevism, if this is what I've seen with my own eyes, if this is Bolshevism, then I'm a Bolshevik. And many others had similar experiences and expressed similar views about the Soviet Union, which, of course, was the result of the October Revolution in 1917.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I notice, and your book points out, is that they had a strategy. They addressed directly the issue of at the time they used the word Negro participation, black participation in the parties, the recruitment, it became an order. That is, they were not going to tolerate excuses for the non-recruitment and emphasis on the super exploited workers of the Caribbean, South Africa, and United States, particularly I noticed in your book.
Yes, I mean, that's true. The book looks at those parties which had particular responsibilities, you could say, because they had they were connected either with colonies in Africa and the Caribbean, say, so communist parties in Britain or France, as well as those which were located in Africa and had, again, particular responsibilities, like the party in South Africa, or like the Communist Party in the United States. And many of those parties, or several of those parties, for different reasons, were reluctant to or slow to take up these particular questions for solution. One of the principles of the Communist International In fact, one of the all communist parties had to be in opposition to the imperialism of their own ruling class, if you like. So they had to take a stand against a colonialism. The British Party had to take a stand against a colonial rule in throughout the British Empire and organize accordingly. And sometimes the parties were reluctant or slow to do that.
Some of them really balked, as you document in the book. They really doubted that was the best policy. They rather weighted down with the ideas of the colonial bosses of their countries.
Yeah, they were slow for various reasons, or they didn't organize amongst the African or Caribbean populations which existed in Britain or France or wherever. And in the U.S. party, there were also a whole range of problems. These were young communist organizations that had all kinds of problems to overcome, including political problems and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, the Communist International endeavored to resolve these problems, to make sure that, as far as was possible, Communist parties did take up the colonial question for solution, or in the United States, as you say, what was then called the Negro question. So it was important that the oppression of African Americans was taken up for solution, that African Americans were recruited, were in the leadership of the parties, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly with the party in South Africa, which initially started off as a party whose membership was mainly of European origin and leadership was of European origin. And the Communist International was most insistent that a communist party in Africa must be a party mainly of Africans, people of African origin, and its leadership must also be of that origin. And also its politics must reflect the problems of that country, which were that Africans were denied the right to govern themselves, and so on. So the Communist Party in South Africa was instructed to deal with those problems, to change its leadership, to change its political orientation, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And these were things which were undertaken through discussions in the congresses of the Communist International, and so on. So it was...
Mm-hmm.
It was setting an example. It was one of the few organizations in that period which took a stand against colonialism, which took a stand against racism, and which endeavored to make sure that these questions were resolved or set up specific organizations to deal with them. And the book charts the history of one of those organizations, the International Trade Union Committee of Negro Workers, which was set up to both to organize black workers and to assist the various communist parties to take up these questions and solve them.
I really appreciated that discussion in the book. Incidentally, it's terrifically footnoted. I once had the opportunity to talk to W.H. Auden, and I asked him if he read Marx, and he said, the footnotes, I love the footnotes. And this has a bunch of wonderful footnotes as well. But the author is Hakim Adi, a doctor. He's going to be here in Toronto on Sunday the 15th at 3 o'clock at a different book list. When I say you're going to be via Skype, I believe.
I'm not going to be there in the flesh, but I will be there through the wonders of modern technology.
Yeah,
and
the pure intellectual product, the thing itself, in essence. I want to ask you lastly, or just say to you, that in your book, you include, thank you very much, a lot of wonderful pictures of people I've heard about over the years and never seen them, or rarely seen any photographs of them. Just terrific people who left a great mark on history. And you also refer to so many wonderful publications of that time. And to me, it was just remarkable that so many great American writers, and I'm speaking of the diaspora, the black writers of America. Here they had, they were editing and putting out terrific publications, in my view, probably ought to be in our hands yet in some series or something, because you'd say someone like Claude McKay or Langston Hughes are names that come to mind, but those, they really had a terrific collection of, I don't know how many of their journals reached the hands of those they were directed toward, but I assume that there was a readership. But that was, your book emphasizes how well engaged they were with their public.
Yeah, I think that's true. There were a whole range of publications. I mean, certainly in the U.S. and one can see the kind of fruit of that work, not just publications, but the organizing work that took place. I mean, that created the conditions for the struggles of the 1950s, 1960s, and so on, which are much more well-known, but the activities of communists, African-American and non-African-American communists, not only in the northern states, but in the southern states, was extremely important in creating the conditions for, let's say, the struggles and victories of later years. And similarly in
The Scarborough Boys.
The Caribbean.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So, yeah, I was just going to say, in regard to the colonies and publications, the situation was much more difficult because many of the publications which communists produced were illegal, mm-hmm. and had to be smuggled into the colonies, of course, by sea, by very difficult routes, by using seafarers in one form or another. Sometimes they were disguised as missionary publications or disguised in some other way, and those who were caught distributing them could often be sentenced to terms of imprisonment. So there were great difficulties involved in producing and distributing this literature outside of countries like the U.S., Britain, and so on. But the communists rose to the task, and in some countries, those who were involved in journalism paid with their lives. And I'm thinking of somebody like André Aliquet, who most people perhaps never heard of, but was the editor of a communist paper in Martinique, which at that time was a French colony in the Caribbean, and was assassinated for his pioneering journalism. So there were all kinds of difficulties and struggles that were waged during that period.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's Dr. Hakim Adi. He's going to be at the different book list via Skype, Sunday, 3 o'clock, October the 15th. His book is Pan-Africanism and Communism, The Communist International, Africa and the Diaspora, 1919-1939. Dr. Adi, it's a pleasure talking to you. I look forward to watching you on Sunday.
Well, thanks very much, and thanks for giving me the time and the opportunity to speak to your listeners. Very much appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, great book. This is CIUT, the Taylor Report, 89.5 FM. I think we have a little music. We'll take a break, and I think it's going to be Blind Willie Johnson.